This is the CRA Podcast, a podcast committed to highlighting the great work across the nation in transforming communities through the power of economic development and the Community Reinvestment Act. And now, here's your host and CRA enthusiast, Linda Lewis-Izuka.
Well, hello there. Since the last podcast episode in April, so much has changed. I was preaching CRA reform and just starting to scrape the surface of COVID-19 and what turned out to be a huge cultural shift of pandemic proportions. I'm so proud of our collective efforts on the front lines. Our bankers are working around the clock to support small businesses through deploying PPP capital while standing up recovery initiatives in partnerships with philanthropic and social service agencies. Everyone is laser focused on what they can do within their sphere of influence, either small or large, to ensure we all emerge stronger and a more resilient collective of the two-legged, as Pluto would say. Today, I have the great honor to interview Ken Thomas, one of our pioneers of the CRA and a fellow CRA enthusiast. Ken Thomas is one of the nation's leading experts and author of the Community Reinvestment Act. He has testified in Congress, advised regulators, trained federal bank examiners, and has written numerous articles and two books on the CRA, including the CRA Handbook. Many of his recommendations were implemented into current CRA regulations. Most recently, he was asked by the Treasury Department, some individual bank regulators, and members of Congress for his input on CRA reform. He has worked with banks, regulators, and community groups in a consulting capacity since the 1977 CRA law was enacted. He has also launched and acted as chair of the Board of Trustees for two nationwide CRA investment mutual funds, including the Community Development Fund, that launched in April 2016. Ken has served on the board of a community bank for over 20 years, and it has received 7 straight outstanding CRA ratings from different bank regulators. Dr. Thomas has received a BSBA from the University of Florida, an MBA from the University of Miami, and an MA and a PhD from the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, where he taught banking and finance for over 42 years. He's a regular speaker and writer in the banking industry, mainly in the American Banker, and he has appeared frequently on ABC Radio, Bloomberg Radio, and CNBC, MSNBC, Nightly Business News, and NPR. So welcome, Ken, to the CRA Today podcast.
Yes, and first of all, thank you very much, Linda, for having me. And of course, as you mentioned, this is my favorite topic, my life's work. And I appreciate being able to share my thoughts with you and your audience on this.
Yes. I know so many of us are working with our banks to support our local communities recover and reopen, yet CRA reform is now on the forefront, and especially for our OCC-regulated entities. I, like you, Ken, try to stay laser-focused on CRA and to avoid politics, yet our beloved CRA seems to have been caught in the crossfire. So today I'd like to focus our time on 4 key elements, starting with a little politics, but then shifting to solutions and impact. We will cover CRA reform. We'll also briefly cover a high-level overview of the OCC's final rule and their framework. We'll talk about the FDIC and the FRB and if there's any hopes for an interagency solution in the future. And we'll end with community development impact and some of our COVID recovery efforts on the line. So Ken, let's start with item number 1, the CRA reform primer. This is not your first rodeo. In fact, you wrote the book, too, in fact. Can you start with a brief high-level overview of CRA and its reform iterations over time?
The best way to look at CRA, I always think about what I call the CRA triangle. which is something I developed in my first book, Community Reinvestment Performance, where we look at the acronym CRA, not to represent Community Reinvestment Act, but to think of it as C for community groups, R at the top of the triangle for the regulators, and A, I forced this, America's banks and thrifts. So we have on one side of the triangle, the community groups representing communities, the public, and on the other side, we have the industry, America's banks. In the middle of the triangle, the top, we have the regulators, kind of like referees. Think of it as a field. We have community groups representing the public on one side, the industry on the other side, and the regulators are supposed to be in the middle as impartial, fair referees trying to get the balance right. CRA is all about getting the right balance of the CRA triangle. We need input from community groups, the industry, and from the regulators. And the problem we've had most recently, of course, with this new reform, the one that just went into effect by the comptroller, is that so many of the community groups, most of them were opposed to it. The banking industry, the major groups representing them, which would be ABA, ICBA, CBA for the big banks, and even the Bank Policy Institute for the very big banks, they were mostly against most of the provisions. And the regulators themselves weren't even on board. The OCC came out first with the ANPR, and then the FDIC joined them with the NPR, but then bailed at the last minute when the final rule came out this week. And then, of course, when the comptroller announced the resignation. So we've had really a CRA triangle that wasn't working effectively as we did back in 1995, when the community groups were basically working on one side against the banking industry, and the Federal Reserve actually was sided with the banking industry. But the other regulators at that time, remember, we had the comptroller, the FDIC, mm-hmm. and the OTS, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. They were all pretty much aligned. So that was a very big difference between what we have today.
Yep, it is a new day, say the least. So who knew that CRA reform could be so dramatic? Like you mentioned, now we have a solo new rule from the OCC, and you know the chairman resigns. What is going on over there? How many banks does this actually affect?
Well, the OCC in general terms regulates, primarily regulates big banks, FDIC primarily small banks, and the Federal Reserve, we focus primarily on their goal in 1913, 1914 for monetary policy, but they also regulate some banks. And so the FDIC and the comptroller together represented about 85% of the banks by number, but the comptroller represents only about 1,200 of our 5,100 banks, roughly 15%. However, these are all the big banks. So we've got nearly 70% of the assets represented by the OCC banks. That's why the OCC is so important, because not by numbers of banks, where the FDIC is strong, but by assets, because they represent all or pretty much all of the big banks. And if you look at the top 10, the top 15, they're almost all national banks. And that's why the OCC is so important.
Wow. Okay. That's great context. Thank you so much. So more specifically, let's move on to item number two, the OCC's final rule. You mentioned in your recent Ballard Spa podcast and the American Bankers article of the 5% rule as it relates to delineating an assessment area. Can you provide a high-level overview of that final rule framework? Now, we're all trying to get our head around that 400-page document. But can you talk about how the OCC supervised banks will delineate their assessment areas?
Yes, this is very important. And again, we have to go back and look at the big picture here. Starting when President Trump was elected, he brought in Mnuchin as Treasury Secretary. Joseph Iden came in as comptroller. And he also appointed FDIC, Jelena McWilliams, and then he appointed the chair of the Fed, Jay Powell. Uniquely, all four of these appointees were business people. They were either from banks, Wall Street, and like the president, they wanted people elected a business person because, you know, business people make things happen. Yep. If you hire a lawyer, you know, lawyers are good at talking, you know, writing laws, and they write, you know, politicians talk, but business people make things happen. And that's what we wanted. So immediately the Treasury Secretary came out with a modernization proposal, some ideas back in 2017, formalized in 18, but the focus was on modernization of CRA, because everybody talks about, and everybody agrees on this one point, since the 95 reforms, we need to modernize it. That's one thing we all agree on.
Yep.
But then the next step was the difference of modernization versus improvement or overhaul. And this is where I had some issues. So for example, we all agree modernization was important. That's where the 5% rule we'll talk about was so valuable. But so many of the people involved with CRA used the modernization excuse to not only improve CRA, but to totally overhaul it.
Yeah.
So for example, let's say you take your car to the dealer and you have a problem with the engine running and it needs a tune-up. And you say, you know what, I'd like you to tune it up. And they come back and they say, Linda, you know what? We have to put a new engine in your car. I said, I don't want an overhaul. I just want a tune-up. So you went in there, you know, to modernize it, to improve it, but you ended up with an overhaul. That's what happened with CRA. The modernization argument was almost a Trojan horse to totally overhaul the law. However, the modernization part of it, the 5% part, is the part I've been so supportive of, because that is, in my opinion, the article you mentioned in the American Banker, that 5% rule is what will really help our low and moderate income areas immensely, especially those areas in our big cities being impacted so much by COVID-19. Yeah. This is where this reform really helps LMI and our first responders. And this is where, unfortunately, there's been so much misunderstanding of what this rule was about.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing. CRA was not broken. In fact, quite effective in so many of our communities. So I'm glad that you mentioned that. And it was just amazing to see what was submitted and all of the swirl around just throwing all of the great elements of CRA out. And the final rule in the framework, even though we're still getting our head around it, I would say 80% of it is still in place, right? We still have the same definitions of community development, right? We still collect and maintain data. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. Can you talk a little bit about what does that framework look like, or what did the OCC recommend, or what prevailed in the final rule, just on a super high level basis?
Sure. I would say, again, I like to divide the rule up into really three categories. Modernization, improvement, and then overhaul, okay? So on the modernization part, the 5% rule I thought was very effective. We discussed this back in 2017. I was invited to meet with the comptroller twice. I discussed this in detail. And the problem with these internet banks, digital banking, which where we need the modernization, is that they are taking deposits from all over the country, but they use assessment areas in their three, what I call sanctuary states, where they have special credit card provisions with the usury laws, namely Utah, Wilmington, Delaware, Salt Lake City, Utah, and Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So they take money from all over the country, deposits, but the benefit only goes to those three communities. For example, my home community of Miami, we have in our local Miami Herald ads from banks like, say, Synchrony Bank, these internet banks from Utah and all over. They suck out not billions, but tens of billions of deposits, and the benefits go back to Utah and those three markets. Now, that's wrong, because the purpose of CRA was community reinvestment. reinvest deposits into the local community. So the 5% rule says very simply, if over 50% of your deposits come from outside of your local assessment area, any market where you have 5% or more of your deposits, and by the way, all banks know where their deposits come from. And if they don't, I would fault the bank for not knowing that. Every bank, especially branchless banks, they know where the money comes from.
Exactly.
They now have a commitment, a responsibility to reinvest back into that community. And these are big cities like New York, for example. Probably tens of billions of dollars are sucked out of New York MSA into these other three markets. Under the new rule, this money would go back, not to the, quote, rich people who support those deposits, not to Central Park, but it'll go back to the Bronx, low moderate income areas, areas where our first responders live. So it's almost like a Robin Hood proposal where the rich deposits come out of the rich areas of New York, but under the 5% rule, we're reinvesting them back into the poor, the low moderate income areas. That's why the monetization part was so important. Yeah, and yet, surprisingly, so many community groups misunderstood it. Even a congressman from New York misunderstood it. And even some banks, of course, the banks from those three areas opposed it because they did not want to have that new requirement. But this is what CRA is about, which is reinvestment.
Absolutely. Amen. So what do we know for sure? Is there any hope for an interagency reunion? Or another way to ask is, what's the likely next steps for the FDIC and the FRB?
To me, that's the most important thing right now, is getting everybody on board with a joint proposal. It may not happen for a while, but it really has to happen before this whole matter is settled and put to bed. The fact that the NPR was changed so significantly with the final rule is very telling, because there are so many parts of it that were changed. So for example, in the NPR, three of the six examination procedures were eliminated, namely wholesale bank, limited purpose, and ISB. They came back. Why did they come back? Well, because, you know, the big wholesale banks like State Street, Bank of New York Mellon, they went in and complained about it directly several times, even after the comment period was over. The banking industry complained about it. So they got that back in. So what in effect that tells me is that the existing rule was working pretty fine. We had six procedures. The NPR brought it down to three, and the final rule took it back to six where it was. So it tells me what you said earlier, that, like, you know, if it ain't broke, why are we fixing it? And so for that reason, I think the only way we're going to get the Fed on board and the FDIC back on board is having something very similar to what we have now. And that is going to rely very heavily on the new comptroller, the acting comptroller, Brian Brooks. And I'm hoping that the community groups, the industry, instead of attacking the OCC, you know, lawsuits, as we saw now with the MCRC lawsuit, attacking them, to go out and try to reach out to the OCC to work out a situation to say, like, look, we know you made some concessions from the NPR to the final rule. What will it take for us to get to a final rule altogether? Because remember, business people like to get things done. They like to negotiate. So this becomes a negotiation. So instead of everybody sitting in their own little three camps, we need to get back together, back to the negotiating table, and say, what will it take? It may take something that looks very much like what we have in the current regs, but several of the improvements that were put forth are very good. For example, giving benefits to bank with outstanding ratings, the list of required, you know, what is CRA required, the focus on LMI, people versus areas. So many of the good ideas in this final rule need to be kept, but we need to sit down and negotiate it. And that's what it's going to take, because unless all three get aboard, we're just going to be spinning our wheel for another few years.
Yeah, it's shocking and frustrating and sad, quite frankly, that now we have a bifurcated system, right? And it will cause some market confusion. And it's just the more we're all spinning around trying to figure out the new regs, and I'm pretty sure there's a bunch of elements in there that nobody anticipated until we get into implementation. You know, I love your concept of let's reconvene, let's negotiate, let's come back together, because the bottom line is we have some work to do. Right? We need to help our most fragile communities recover and then eventually emerge and thrive. So I think the most important work ahead is around our fourth and final element on podcast today, is around community development, right? And some of our COVID recovery thoughts. So, lawsuits and the political engines and everything will hum and swirl in DC. But what are some of your deep thoughts around what banks can do today or tomorrow and how they can further serve in the COVID-19 recovery efforts in their communities?
Well, as you know, I've been on a board of a bank myself for 20 years, and I've consulted with banks for 50 years. And I can tell you, and I talk with bankers all day, I've talked with several this morning, their primary focus right now, where it should be, is really not on CRA, but it's on PPP, getting those loan mods done, loan modifications, helping our communities recover, helping our small businesses reopen, helping us get the economy back on track. That's our primary focus. So now we say, well, how can CRA help that? I believe the single most important thing that Joseph Addy did with this NPR and the final rule was this 5% rule, because we are talking about literally hundreds of billions of dollars of deposits from these big credit card banks that could help New York City, the LMI areas, the areas in Queens, in the Bronx, portions of Brooklyn that have been most hurt by the COVID. These monies can help them recover immediately. And it's not just them. My original hometown of Detroit, they need help. There's credit card banks are not helping Detroit very much, but they're taking money out of the Detroit MSA. It could go back into helping Detroit, Miami, Chicago, LA. So this is where we need help. And I would ask that the FDIC and the Fed immediately consider at least applying that 5% rule. That's something that I think we could all agree on. And if we don't all agree on it, it's because we don't understand it. And of course, the only people who are going to disagree with this will be the credit card banks themselves. And of course, the people that benefit in Wilmington, Sioux Falls, and Salt Lake City, because they get the benefits now of the CRA, hundreds of billions of dollars from all over the country. I mean, think about this one fact. Those three states together represent less than 2% of our population, less than 2% of our businesses, but they represent 13% of all deposits. That, if you do the math, it's over $1 trillion of deposits that could be benefiting these other communities. That money could be reinvested and should be reinvested in low moderate income communities, especially those where a lot of our first responders live, those that are being impacted by COVID. And I don't see any reason why this cannot be implemented immediately, not just by the OCC, but the FDIC and the Fed, and that would help these communities immensely.
Well, it's a nice, natural, organic solution and pretty fundamental to the reinvestment definition, right? And if nothing else, if we change nothing else to modernize, right, that can have a tremendous impact.
Absolutely. Because remember, when we first went down this road, when Trump got elected and he brought in Mnuchin, they said, modernize CRA. We haven't done anything since 1995. We didn't have, the big use of the internet. We didn't have cell phones, digital banking, branches bank. So modernize, modernize, modernize. The 5% rule does that, but we were not asked to overhaul the whole thing. And that's what we have here. We can modernize and we can improve, but we don't need to overhaul something that's working. Remember, 98% of all banks get a passing rating. Now, if you can pass 98% of the time, why do you want to change that? And the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis did a monumental study showing of all bank regulations, the most expensive, the one banks are having the most trouble with now, is BSA, with about 21% of all costs. CRA is only 7%, one third of that amount. It's only number six on the list. So why are we attacking number six when we should be focusing on BSA, where banks really need help? But of course, the focus today has got to be on PPP, loan mods, and helping the recovery. That's where we've got to really focus.
Yep. Instead of trying to figure out a new rule and reformatting systems and processes and procedures. Anyway, thank you for that perspective. And I just wanted to end with some gratitude. Thank you for being so generous. And I hope that you will come back on because I have so much more to ask you and to share with others based on your long history of serving low-income communities.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm going to leave you with this final thought. In my office here in Miami, I have up on the wall a famous quote posted by my very famous hero, Senator William Proxmire from 1988. And I've got this posted on my wall. I look at it every morning. And this is a quote of his about regulators and CRA. And let me quote from what he said. Quote, regulators seem to think that we're all living in Lake Wobegon. Like the children of the fictional village, U.S. lenders are all above average. Almost all get high ratings year after year, and almost none is ever held back. And I ask myself, how is it that so many neighborhoods are continuing to fail while so many lending institutions are continuing to pass? That is always a reminder to me. Every day when I wake up and turn on my computer, I look at that quote and I think, what would Senator Proxmire want from his CRA? And I think he would be very happy with the modernization, and I think he would agree with these improvements. But the overhaul that we've seen here, I just think, we go back, if it ain't broke, why do we need to fix it? And we need to modernize it and improve it, and I hope these three agencies can get together, and I think Senator Proxmire would be very happy if that was the case.
Oh, thank you for that. It's such a sage reflection, and I love the thought, what would Senator Proxmire do? And now I can add, what would Ken Thomas do? And thank you so much for your time. I look forward to hearing you again and interviewing and sharing some time to share then with our listeners. So thank you so much.
And the same to you. Thank you, Linda. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the CRA Podcast with Linda Lewis-Izuka. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, cratoday.com. Don't forget to leave us a positive review on iTunes and be sure to check out our archive section on our website for previous podcasts. Join us next time for another edition of the CRA Podcast.